Coming up on Weekend America.
When you talk about race, it's easy to have a verbal screw-up. But what if your screw-up appears in the paper?
It's just such a hard conversation for this country to have. And that conversation is heightened, for good or ill, in the news media.
The press gathers in Chicago to try to get race right. I'm John Moe.
And I'm Bill Radke. There's a fundraising drive underway for a new museum, and it's not going to be easy.
One man actually said to me, "Why do you want to build a memorial to unwed mothers?" And that is a perfect place to start the conversation.
A private museum of public housing. And some folks are taking a little bike ride this weekend, or a big bike ride.
People think twice about driving, 100 miles or 150 miles. So the idea that you could do that on a bike, that was just intriguing to me.
Grab some water. It's Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. In St. Paul, I'm John Moe, in for Desiree Cooper.
And I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. This weekend, the area around a California Buddhist retreat is smoldering after a forest fire. We'll find out what destruction looks like to a Zen monk. In Chicago this weekend, there's a reunion of public housing residents. They're recalling struggles, friendships, and lessons they don't want to be forgotten. And as the Tour de France wraps up this weekend, we take up ultra-bicycling, as in across America, in 11 days. How far do you figure you could ride a bike?
Well, as long as the ground's flat, I don't think there'd be much limit to it. But if it's the hills of Cincinnati, I don't think I'll make it more than a mile.
The Chinese restaurant to get Crab Rangoon, which is like 2 miles from my house.
10 miles, and I would ride to a friend's house so they could drive me home.
Oh, I guess I could ride probably as far as I wanted.
I could ride about 20 miles. To Hudson, Wisconsin.
I could ride 60, 70 miles. That is something that I do a lot. And I even have a basket on my bike to take my dogs.
I wonder if the dogs like going 60 or 70 miles. I guess it's just like leaning their head out of a car.
Good point. Good point. Those voices came to us from St. Paul, Cincinnati, and Lincoln, Nebraska.
Well, this weekend in Chicago, journalists of color are gathered at the Unity Conference. It's a 5-day event. It happens once every 4 years. And it's focused on the challenges and opportunities of diversity coverage. 6,000 people are in attendance, including our own Desiree Cooper. Senator Barack Obama addresses the convention tomorrow. Now, with a presidential candidate who's African-American and with immigration being a major issue, topics of race and ethnicity are unavoidable, and that means no slip-up about race in the media will go unnoticed. Desiree Cooper had a chance to talk to two veteran journalists, Alex Cruden, a former editor of the Detroit Free Press, who is a white male, and Mary Sanchez, who is a columnist for the Kansas City Star and who is Latina.
Alex, I want to ask you, what would you say is a first step toward getting race right as a journalist?
Admitting that you can get it wrong. I can illustrate perhaps with a story. I'm a white male boomer, had good college record, and I'm a sensitive guy too. So I was right all the time, well, one would think. And one day early on at the Detroit Free Press, early on in my time there as Nation and World editor, I got a phone call from someone I didn't know, and she accused me of being a racist. And I was immediately angry.
Well, let me stop you there. How did you happen to be in the line of fire? What happened?
Well, actually, it was something that wasn't in the story. It was how the story was done. It was a national story, and it had a racial aspect to it. And I think it was one of those where some people would say, well, race is not relevant to it. But in fact, race was.
I remember once I was the editor of an alternative newsweekly in Detroit. We did a story about people who were collecting Jim Crow memorabilia. I ran this story, and I ran as the cover art. It was racist Jim Crow art that was in my own collection that I had collected. So I'm a black woman running a paper. The art is from my own house that we actually ran on the cover. I cannot tell you how many times I was called racist that day. And it just blew me away because I was like, but I'm black. Like, this is my stuff, you know? Like, why can't I talk about my stuff in this paper? What I didn't realize is that for the community, institutions often are colorless, which means that they are white.
Oh, absolutely. It's like a fallback.
Well, and it's statistically true.
Well, and that's also the problem that minority journalists have in terms of you're the exception. I'm still going to hold on to that I want to believe mainstream media or mainstream whatever is racist and inherently bad and against me, my ethnic or racial group. So when I find a reporter that doesn't fit that, that gets the story right, you're going to be the exception.
Alex, I want to ask you because, you know, being a copy chief, you're the last line of defense, like before that headline goes out, that photo, that cut line, the story itself. How does race play in what you do? What is the calculus that you use?
Just the act of working together with a staff that's diverse in age and in gender and background can help a lot. The other thing, and this is what I think is the most important for journalists, is to work in a context where you can always ask a question, a real question, and get a real answer. And that can be as simple as if you're a white assigning editor working with a minority reporter, before you send the story over, just say very sincerely, and you have to mean it, "Now, is there anything that bothers you about what we just did?" And to be able to have a relationship that you get an honest answer in that.
You know, that is a great rule. Coming from my own background, I know there were several times when I was a younger reporter trying to write on sensitive racial issues that I don't think I had the finesse to work with editors often to really get the whole story into the paper the way I intended it. Or I couldn't tell an editor as they were splicing a certain word and putting in another exactly why the word I had chosen had been chosen and why the one that they had chosen might come across as demeaning or not completely the full truth. But that was on me.
I saw a headline once, and it was at the Detroit Free Press, where I'm still a columnist. And it said this was when the University of Florida, there was something going on with football, which I wasn't even following. I pick up the paper, I see the sports page, and there's this huge headline that says alligator bait. Now, I'm sure that's gone on with the Gators forever. Alligator bait is always in a story when it comes to the Gators. But seeing this huge headline just out of nowhere that said alligator bait, and it just sent shudders down my spine because that is what, in the Jim Crow South, they would refer to black children as alligator bait. And there were like little postcards, and it was just kind of a common, funny thing that black children were alligator bait. And I don't know if anyone saw that. Alex, do you remember that headline?
Yes, I do. Having spent some time in the South, I knew, and I was shocked. It was not a headline I saw before publication, but it just popping out so large. And we have at the Free Press a lot of Southern readers, but nobody on the desk that night seemed to get it. And that's the kind of thing where, you know, just because you have diversity and great intentions and all that, that's not a guarantee.
You know, actually, though, that kind of reminds me of something that it's a subtlety that goes on about writing about race is how often do you have to keep bringing up the past and where things were? When I used to write race relations for the Kansas City Star, is I would define, what is a story going to do? Is it going to showcase a racial or ethnic group, a, quote, minority community, to the majority audience? Am I explaining something that they may not have completely understood because it's not their experience? Or am I trying to showcase a racial or ethnic group so that they can see themselves reflected accurately in the paper? And some stories were both.
Alex, Mary, thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Des.
The Unity Conference in Chicago continues through tomorrow. You can see some of that Jim Crow era art that Des was talking about at our website, weekendamerica.org.
This is the show about what America is doing this weekend. In California, that means fire cleanup.
In the Big Sur area, fires that have burned for a month are now mostly contained. The area's national parks are open again this weekend, but voluntary evacuations are still in effect, which means people who live there need special passes to get in. And that includes the monks at the Tassajara Zen Mountain Center. Steve Stuckey is the co-abbot of Tassajara. When the evacuation order came, he and a small staff stayed behind, not to fight the fire exactly, but to encourage the flames to go around their home.
A Buddhist relationship to fire is, first of all, that we cultivate an awareness of our interconnection. So it's one of our basic teachings of Buddhism is that everything is interconnected. From a Buddhist point of view, we don't regard fire, say, as an enemy. We'd regard fire as, in a sense, a part of ourselves. And so that may be a little unusual. The relationship that Zen Buddhists might have with the elements may have a paradoxical element in it, in that on the one hand, we're not attached to the outcome, so whatever happens can happen. On the other hand, we have a practice of taking good care of things. Say, Zen is one half sitting meditation and the other in silence and stillness, and the other half is activity of taking care of things, of tending the garden. So it may seem unusual to think of a wildfire as something that we're tending, but it's actually that spirit of we're tending the fire. So we're giving it some guidance and definitely drawing a line saying, here, please turn and go the other way, and supporting that by our action. We're using ordinary tools of shovels and fire hoses and so forth, and encouraging the fire to find its path around us rather than through us. Maybe a little like the spirit of judo or aikido, where you take the energy that's coming at you and turn it or dance with it rather than oppose it directly. Well, it's quite a shock to people coming into Tassajara because the mountains that are covered, normally covered with brush, with manzanita, ceanothus, chamise, pine trees, there are miles in which that's just all gone. And all you see is blackened stubs, stumps, bare twigs and stems. When I look around at the surrounding mountains of Tassajara now, I get a sense of familiarity because I've been through the whole process of the fire. I see a kind of a dark beauty, and there's also a feeling of openness because where our trails before were obscured and covered, now they're open. In a larger sense, this is an ecosystem that for millions of years has gone through periods of fire, and all the plants and various forms of life that are, you know, acclimated to that actually need a fire to move through and open things up and refresh and begin anew. That's all part of what I feel when I see it.
This weekend, Abbot Steve Stuckey is at Tassajara cleaning up and preparing to reopen his Zen Mountain Center. This is Weekend America.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, the latest cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat.
A housing project sometimes doesn't look like much from the outside, but it can be home to a family, a community, and maybe history too, ahead on Weekend America. It's Weekend America from American Public Media. I'm John Moe, along with Bill Radke. Today at Union Park in Chicago, hundreds of former residents of Henry Horner Public Housing High-Rise have gathered for their annual reunion. Now, most of the old high-rise projects have been destroyed, but a few former residents are trying to preserve their history by starting the Public Housing Museum. The proposed site is on Chicago's Near West Side in a building that was part of a project called the Jane Addams Homes. It was built in 1938. Sonny Fisher and Crystal Palmer are both on the board that is trying to turn the building from its current dilapidated state into the museum and tourist attraction they think it can be. They spoke with Weekend America's Desiree Cooper about the effort.
Sonny, you are raising money for the museum. Both of you are. What is...
Yep.
What is that like? You know, when you walk into a room or you approach a group of people and say, hey, we're trying to raise money for a National Public Housing Museum, do you get the tilt of the head like,
A lot of people do look at me kind of, what are you, crazy? And one man actually said to me, why do you want to build a memorial to unwed mothers? And that is a perfect place to start the conversation. Is to say, well, you know, what do you mean? Or how many of us in this room were raised by a single parent? And what happened to us? And what do we think is some of the reasons for that? And we can go into the policies. And that's one of the things the museum will do. And it will be a place where we can confront stereotypes. We can talk about issues of race and poverty.
I think that America has an idea of what it meant to live in public housing, even if most of America never lived in public housing. What will surprise America about the stories that they'll find at that museum? Crystal, is there something you can tell me about that?
You'll find that they were normal people, first of all, and that those stories were actually other people's versions of what residents of public housing or myths of what public housing was like. Like most communities may have issues, but actually I enjoyed it. I lived there. I grew up there from 1968 to 89. And when I moved there in 68, it was a wonderful place. It was beautiful. It was quiet. It was family oriented.
How is that different in the 80s?
Oh, that's when things start tumbling. I don't know what happened to the resources or whatever came about that the services started diminishing and people stopped caring. It just went downhill from there.
Sonny, you also lived in public housing.
Right.
What was that like for you as a child?
Well, it was pretty similar to the way Crystal was describing it.
When was this?
This was in the 50s and early 60s. Many people were working. There were a lot of intact families. There were playgrounds, and we had libraries. I went to first and second grade in the development, and the development itself was surrounded by middle-class and working-class homes. So we went to school with a very diverse group of kids. But I think that Crystal's point is that they were abandoned. The people were abandoned. The buildings were abandoned. They stopped making repairs.
The residents didn't get the city services as the ambulance, the police department.
I remember going into one of the high rises, and my father was a mailman, and I remember seeing all of the mailboxes pulled out of the walls, and it was sort of a symbol of not even being able to get your mail from your own home.
Well, Crystal, you moved out of public housing, and then you moved back in. You're currently in public housing.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you move back?
I moved back because it's my home. It's where my connection is. I would not have wanted to move any other place if I had opportunity, but back home.
Can you talk to me a little bit more about that? I think that people might feel confusion about that if there's a chance to quote-unquote, move up and move out, that one would take that opportunity.
Who says I haven't moved up? I'm a productive member of this society. I do a lot of community work. I've moved up. And then I look at the mixed-income community when they tore down the buildings. There are suburban people that are moving into the community. So I ask you, have they moved up? Have they moved up? They moving into our communities. So is it about where you live that you move up? Is it about that you are happy where you live?
Sonny, if you could please paint a picture of the building that you want to house the National Public Housing Museum.
Well, the building was part of a huge complex of 32 buildings that were the Jane Addams homes. It was one of the first public housing developments in the country. Right now, all of the buildings are down except this one at 1322 West Taylor. And it has wonderful little amenities, little balconies, really decent-sized rooms, terrific ventilation, and wonderful light. Right now, it's boarded up, and it has a demolition fence around it, and we're trying very hard to save it for the museum.
What exactly is worth saving in that building?
We believe that what's worth saving, not only the building itself, but the stories of the people who live there. About 6 or 7 years ago, I was doing some work for a foundation in the city, and I had to go to a library on the west side. And in the library parking lot, there were three young girls. They were probably 11, 12, 13, and they were beating up a little kid who was probably a boy who was about 7 or 8, I think. And scrappy kid, he was doing the best he could, but they were really pummeling him. And I was bigger than they were, so I walked over to them and I stopped the fight. And they said to me, "Don't worry about him, he's from the projects." That just hit me, and partly because I said, "I'm from the projects." And partly because it gave me a sense about the surrounding community. The surrounding community said that this kid didn't matter. And that me, a stranger, somebody from the outside, would immediately say, "Oh, okay, well, he's from the projects, then go ahead, keep beating him up." One of the things that we hope to do with the museum is to reframe what public housing was in the past, why it became what it did, and perhaps the kind of responsibility that we have to take for all communities.
And hopefully we can learn lessons from the past so we won't have to revisit them in the future.
Well, Sonny and Crystal, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for your interest.
Thank you very much for hearing our stories.
There are photos of the abandoned building that one day might be a museum. That's at our website, weekendamerica.org. Special thanks to American Public Media's documentary unit, American Radio Works. They'll take a look at the history of public housing and examine the future of mixed-income housing as part of their series, The Real Face of Poverty, later this fall.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Executive MPA Program.
In our high-tech world, there's still room for an old-fashioned barn raising. We'll take you there ahead on Weekend America. Oh, one thing, the barn has solar panels.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with John Moe.
And it's time for your letters, some of which apparently are being written with typewriters. Last week, we brought you the story of Dee Williams and her tiny house. Emma Benderup from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, left this comment on our website. I'm curious about the plumbing situation this puts the inhabitants of these houses in. Well, in that story, we learn that Dee has no running water, so she gets fresh water from a neighbor for dishes and collects dishwater to water plants. She showers at work. And she has a composting toilet, but it's illegal in the city where she lives, so she lines the toilet with a bag and mixes waste with peat moss, then bags it up and throws it away. So now you know that.
I thought we answered that listener question extremely thoroughly.
Yes, yes. We also have all the details.
Yes. We also told you about planned obsolescence, the idea that manufacturers deliberately phase out styles just to get us to buy the same stuff over and over. Several of you pointed out to us that this is not some capitalist plot. Humans are hardwired to shop. To check out that theory, we called up Dr. David Sulzer, professor of neurology, psychology, and pharmacology at Columbia University Medical School, and he said, not so fast.
You can't really say any complicated behavior like that is hardwired. It has to do with your life and your experiences and what you've tried and what you've found to make an effect on your environment. And you define what you do out of that. And yeah, your brain rewires itself according to that. But to say that we're hardwired to shop would be like saying I'm hardwired to speak English and you're hardwired to speak Spanish.
Interesante, Dr. David Sulzer.
Last week, reporter Chrissy Clark revisited M.F.K. Fisher's book, How to Cook a Wolf. Fisher wrote the book in 1942, just as food rationings began in this country. The book wasn't about cooking wolves, but it was about how to make meals during lean times. And that story struck a chord with Shlomit Asiello, who listens to us in Rockland, Maine. It reminded her of a cookbook she wrote in 1996.
My cookbook was named Eye of Newt, subtitled A Conjurer's Cookbook for the Working Poor. And I named it that because it was 1996 and the Republicans had just issued their contract with America. And a lot of us felt that we were being trickled down upon. My husband is a sculptor and I help him run his business. He makes beautiful things out of stone. But we're self-employed and our income is very uneven. And we have always lived close to the edge. When that winter came, 1996, things were just as tight as they'd ever been for us. I spent a lot more time at home. I had a young family. I was doing a lot of preparing food, a lot of doing large batches, baking 4 loaves of bread at a time or 8 to 16 quarts of soup at a time, putting it in the freezer. And while things were in the oven, I started writing them down. In addition, we had just discovered community-supported agriculture, which was a way to pay for our food up front when the farmer was ordering seed and get vegetables and in some cases meat and dairy products on a weekly basis. One time when we needed lunch in a hurry, I looked in the refrigerator and I had some leftover potato leek soup, and I knew that in the freezer I had a lot of Maine shrimp. I took the shrimp and I sauteed it in a little bit of oil with a little bit of onion, and then I added the potato leek soup on top of it, and I threw a few curry spices in, some cumin and some coriander, and it just tasted great. The three things that I would tell someone who's learning how to cook on a budget but wants to really eat good food would be, first of all, it's worthwhile to invest in some little jar of special condiment that's going to really add something to your meals. I have a jar of Oyster Creek mushroom powder. I paid $8.50 for it 2 years ago. Well, I use a half a teaspoon, a quarter of a teaspoon at the beginning of making a soup while I'm stirring the onions in. And it puts a meaty flavor to the onions. Onions themselves are indispensable in the kitchen. You can start a soup with them. You can make a little bit of a something to put over a boring piece of meat, raw, cooked. They're wonderful. And I think the most important thing I would do if I was starting again is what I do now, which is hook up with a local farmer. They'll make sure that you're eating well, the food's going to be clean, it's going to be healthy, and you'll probably save money in the long run.
Simplicity. It's the new revolution in food, I guess.
We love to hear from you, so why not drop us a note when you visit us at weekendamerica.org. We'll be right back.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From St. Paul, I'm John Moe, along with Bill Radke in Los Angeles. You hear a lot of people talking, especially in recent months, about trying to achieve lifestyles that are greener, less burdensome on the planet, lighter carbon footprint. But for many Americans, the cost of cutting that carbon footprint in a recession economy is still way too high, especially when it comes to home improvement. You're kind of in a pickle. Do you save the planet? Do you save your house? Do you save your wallet? Well, a group of New Hampshire residents is trying to do all three. They're going for the 2008 Green Trifecta. Would that be a ecofecta, I suppose? Mm-hmm. They've found a way to use their weekends to help reduce the cost of going solar. Reporter Shannon Mullen takes us there.
It's a drizzly Saturday morning, perfect for staying in bed or making pancakes. Instead, about 40 people in rain gear are doing free manual labor in Kevin Frank's backyard.
We're putting up a solar collector array.
In the rain?
In the rain. And it'll provide radiant floor heat as well as domestic hot water.
By the end of the day, Kevin's new solar water heater will be helping save the planet, and he'll have saved thousands of dollars in installation costs using volunteer labor instead of professional plumbers and contractors. So what's in it for the volunteers?
We're eventually going to be going to probably everyone's house here that's here today and putting in a system.
Peter Adams runs a nonprofit called the Plymouth Area Renewable Energy Initiative, or PERE. Its mission is to make solar more affordable by reducing the upfront investment. PERE members go to each other's houses. Peter teaches them some home improvement skills.
All right, so who wants to learn how to solder? Everyone raise your hand. No, you can't. No.
Then everyone spends a Saturday helping install a solar water heater. They call these group efforts energy raisers.
We certainly kind of stole that saying from the Amish with the whole concept of barn raising.
Co-founder Sandra Jones says installing a system this way saves $2,500 in labor costs. And that brings the price for the average four-person household down to about $2,000 after state and federal tax rebates.
Definitely opens the door for solar for people where that much money makes a huge difference for them in their budget. And I have to say, you know, that was my case, too.
Another case in point, volunteer Ted Stiles has a green conscience, but he also has a wife and two kids and a public high school teacher's salary. The family uses a lot of hot water, and Ted says putting in a solar water heater could save hundreds of gallons of heating oil a year.
With the price of oil being what it is, that means in two or three years, something like this would pay itself off in our house.
Like most of PERE's 250 members, Stiles is no handyman. But despite the lack of expertise, this group's done more than two dozen energy raisers so far, with only a few minor snafus, mostly involving soldering irons. Sandra says working with the stuff seems to make the volunteers forget they're adults.
Put the tubes in, everybody.
It's mid-afternoon, and the volunteers are about to install the last piece in Kevin Frank's solar heating system. They're attaching 30 glass tubes to his roof. As the sun beats down on the tubes, a vacuum acts like a coffee thermos to insulate the liquid warming up inside. Then the heat gets transferred to a basement water tank. The volunteers pass the tubes along an assembly line, up a series of ladders to the roof.
You guys look Amish up there. Looks cool. Looks like you're on an old barn or something.
New Hampshire may have a higher per capita rate of carbon consciousness than some other states, but this group says its solar energy raiser concept should be doable for anyone with a roof, some friends, and maybe some coffee and donuts to help entice them out of bed on a Saturday morning. For Weekend America, I'm Shannon Mullen in New Hampshire.
There's an information session at Sandra Jones's house in New Hampshire today for new members. Anyone who wants to learn more about going solar can show up. To learn more about the group's energy raiser process and to see photos from the event at Kevin Frank's house, go to our website, weekendamerica.org.
This radio show is about the American weekend, and for many of us, that does not mean leisure. We've been bringing you a series called Weekend Shift about people who work Saturdays and Sundays. Today, we meet Deborah Nichols. What she does on the weekends is give her clients care and solace. It's a service they'll need for the rest of their lives. Reporter Katie Sewell has our story.
A year ago, Deborah Nichols quit her day job and started homeschooling her son, Connor. His first weeks of kindergarten hadn't gone well. He was acting out and coming home exhausted. Now Deb spends her weekdays sitting at the kitchen table, teaching her son to read.
Let's say the word can. Can.
Air.
You spelled the word can. Touch and say the word letters.
To make ends meet, Deborah works on the weekends as a hospice nurse, caring for the terminally ill. It's a big contrast. She spends her weekdays with a rambunctious young child, and on the weekends, she cares for the dying.
I get to be involved in one of the most intimate times of life. I've actually been at bedsides that remind me of a birth experience, and all the family gathers, the friends and the family, and they're coaching that person on. It's a very beautiful passage. It's the same passage like birth. And I feel it's a pretty sacred trust that we get to be there.
The job of a hospice care nurse is to make life better for dying patients. It's not about staving off death or hastening it on. Deborah's there to make the last months comfortable, medically and emotionally. On a recent Sunday, Deborah's workday begins. She drives her big blue van toward an assisted living facility. John, a 91-year-old hospice patient, needs to have a leaking catheter replaced. The hospital wouldn't allow last names to be used.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi, Dad.
John's lying in a medical bed in a large, stark room, with his wife Hazel at his side. He has long limbs and piercing blue eyes. At age 26, when he married his wife, he must have been dashing. Now his eyelids droop with sickness and age. He isn't eating well, and hallucinations are clouding his vision. His wife brushes her hand across his forehead, her voice echoing in the large, sparse room.
He's very restless.
Yeah.
Yeah. What scares you the most, John?
Well, not living.
Not living?
Not living.
Deborah hears from patients all the time that they are scared of not living. It's her job to be reassuring.
Well, you know, we're here to try to make that more of a peaceful process for you.
I know that.
Yeah.
Deb is a comforting presence, but John knew what was coming. He died a few days later. His wife was with him.
We get to witness couples that have been together for decades and their final moments together. It's very, very beautiful. And you see what's really important in a relationship, someone who's going to be there in that final moment, take care of you and deal with all the less than pretty parts and still love you through all that.
John and Hazel had spent 65 years together. Part of Deborah's job is to support couples, those still living together and those recently separated by death. That same day, a hospice patient named Michelle passed away. She was only 50 years old and had been battling MS for over 20 years. Deb is sent to her home. The little brown house is shrouded by trees. Stray cats eat free food on the rusted red porch. And inside, Michelle lies in her hospital bed with her eyes slightly open. Deb's there to help Michelle's husband, Ross. He quit his job in 2000 to take care of her.
So 8 years.
And she wasn't permanently, she's been permanently bedridden. But yeah, this is, you know, it's the way it's been. So like everything in life, you know, it comes to an end, I guess.
His voice sounds steady, but his eyes are full of tears as he remembers his wife.
Like I say, I've never seen a woman fight something the way she did. She spent years on that walker because she knew when she got in a chair, she'd never get out. But, I mean, the pain it caused her.
Ross talks for more than an hour. Deb listens and commiserates. It's at these moments, even more than when she's providing medical care, that Deb feels her work is appreciated.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Deb wipes a tear from her eye as she walks away. It's not just a job to her. The weight of death stays with her all week, even when she's back teaching her son on Monday.
By the end of the weekend, I am really excited to see my healthy son and be thankful for my healthy son and be grateful for his joy in life and living. Tomorrow, something could happen. So it gives me a little more patience in those moments that are a little more trying. That I'm certainly very thankful I have him in my life.
Deborah's on intimate terms with something most of us avoid considering: death. And for her, knowing how life ends makes the beginning that much more alive. In Seattle, Washington, I'm Katie Sewell for Weekend America.
Residents of South Padre Island in Texas are cleaning up this weekend as they recover from the damage of Hurricane Dolly. Here's a look at what else is happening around the country. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. But in Oklahoma, it's another word for, I'm being swarmed by bats. Freedom Oklahoma hosts the Selman Bat Watch, featuring 79 degrees, clear skies, and a million Mexican free-tailed bats. A confused Lou Dobbs will be on hand to demand those swarming jobs be given to hardworking American bats. Medora, North Dakota is not a boring place to be this weekend. Thunderstorms, 89 degrees, and meat eaten off of a pitchfork. Works like this. Take steak, impale, roast over open flame, de-pitchforkify, then eat. Pitchfork fondue, they call it. Pitchforks? Open flames? It's steak the way Satan used to make. Remember when you were a kid playing that game where you had to run around but make sure you didn't fall in the hot lava? On Hawaii's Big Island, it's really happening. The Kilauea Volcano Run features three different runs under showers and 82 degrees, all among lava fields from an active volcano. They should lay out couches on the lava fields for more of that rec room feel. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
When your friends tell you something is too risky, you'd better listen. But what do you do after you've listened? That's next on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Online at Calvert.com.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with John Moe. Today is the penultimate stage of the Tour de France. All eyes are on the Spanish cyclist, Carlos Sastre, the overall leader. Don't count out the Aussie, though, Cadel Evans. When the tour ends in Paris tomorrow, the riders will have covered 2,100 miles, two-thirds the way across the United States. To you, maybe that's a long time to be on a bike. To Candace Deddens, it's practically a sprint. Weekend America's Charlie Schroeder introduces us to someone who did exactly what her wise friends begged her not to do.
When Candace Deddens was 50 years old, she lived in Denver, Colorado, and was going through a tough time. She was divorced, and her kids were grown up and out of the house. And watching the news depressed her. It reminded her of man's inhumanity to man.
That on top of just living in a big city with, you know, traffic and people and crime and all that, it just was all too much all at once.
But there was one thing she kept thinking about that would make her feel better. For years, she had dreamed about getting on her bike and riding across the country.
Many people said, oh, no, you know, you better not do that. It'll be too dangerous. You're a woman. You're too old. It's a bad idea.
And for a while, Candace believed them. Then, one day, while driving to work, she heard someone on the radio quote Theodore Roosevelt. The next day, she saw the same quote in the paper. Later that week, she heard the quote again on TV. The quote that goes, "Far better it is to dare mighty things, even though checkered by failure, than to rank with those poor spirits
who neither enjoy nor suffer much because they live in the gray twilight that knows neither victory nor defeat."
After hearing the quote over and over again, Candace decided to do as Roosevelt suggested and dare a mighty thing.
I needed a break, and I told my boss I was quitting, and I sold my house and got on my bike and took off.
At 50, Candace hit the road alone. Just she, her bike Teddy, named after Roosevelt, and a few of her belongings.
Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way.
She started in Missouri and headed east, then circled back out west.
And although I was not traveling near Christmas time, I know a lot of Christmas songs, so I would sing Christmas songs.
In 8 months, she pedaled through 23 states.
O'er the fields we go, laughing all the way.
All those warnings from her friends that it was risky for a 50-year-old woman to ride alone across the country never amounted to much. In campgrounds, people cooked her meals. When she met other cyclists, they invited her to stay in their homes. One woman even offered her money because she thought Candace was destitute.
I said, no, I'm doing this on purpose. And she just insisted, and finally I just, you know, allowed her to give me a small amount of cash because she was so worried and concerned.
Candace, who'd been down on so many things, had a renewed faith in her country.
Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh.
Toward the end of her trip, Candace rode through Washington State, where she lived for a bit as a child. While there, she visited familiar places from her youth, like
the Forbidden Trestle.
Yeah, we weren't supposed to go there.
That's Candace's older brother, David Jones. He wasn't much of a biker, but he joined her on the ride through Washington anyway, which, of course, included a pit stop at that trestle. Forbidden because it was located just beyond the outflow for the sewage processing plant, where, as kids, they weren't allowed to swim.
But we did because that's where the lake got warmest in the spring when the ice melted.
Right. Guess why?
David's an aerospace engineer, so the job of calculating distances fell on his shoulders, which worked pretty well for the pair until the last day of their journey when he underestimated the distance by 50 miles. So that day, they ended up riding 125 miles.
But we sort of didn't have any choice. Had to keep rolling.
David's a former marathon runner, and for years, Candace had been trying to get him into cycling, but it just didn't give him the same high as running.
And I said, "You're not riding long enough or hard enough."
But that day, churning out 125 miles, everything changed for David.
People think twice about driving, you know, 100 miles or 150 miles. Or at least I do. The idea that you could do that on a bike, I don't know, that was just intriguing to me.
Candace eventually finished her trip. But for David, it was just the beginning. Soon thereafter, he rode 200 miles in a single day. Later, he rode 300 miles in a day.
And I think that's when the real competitive thing started to come in for me.
Now David competes in the Race Across America, a grueling 3,000-mile coast-to-coast race. He did it for the third time this year at the age of 61. He rode 22 hours a day. Candace was his crew chief.
And it was to the point where he would fall asleep on the bike.
It took David a little over 11 days to cross America. It took Candace 8 months. One ride was existential, the other competitive. But oddly, both Candace and David came to a similar conclusion.
That I can do things. That even when the going is hard, that I can keep going.
That I had those reserves that basically everyone does.
And until you put yourself in that place where you have to be tested, you don't know those reserves are there. I'm Charlie Schroeder for Weekend America.
I'm just traveling, traveling, traveling. I'm just traveling through. Or sometimes the road is rugged and it's hard to travel. But holding to each other, we don't have.
And so another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America coasts to a stop and pedals back and forth so as not to fall over. I'm Bill Red.
I'm John Moe. There's a bologna festival in Yale, Michigan today. So if you like bologna and are in Yale, Michigan, then go to the bologna festival. You can download a free podcast of our entire program when you go to weekendamerica.org. It's also available at iTunes. Get out there and enjoy your weekend.
Weekend America is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independence in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
On the next Weekend America, buckle up, leave home behind, and hit the road.
It just sounded like another one of Dad's road trips where we drive and drive and drive, and he won't stop to go to the bathroom. It's like, oh, my gosh.
Anything can happen out there. So gas up the minivan and join us for the next Weekend America.